Studio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for QNN 20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on the air.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. Tonight, we have from Los Angeles, Mr. Jim DiEugenio. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, Len.
Always a pleasure to speak to you, Jim. Your wealth of information in this topic, I think people tune in just to hear your side of the view down from Los Angeles area and American point of view. Well, welcome.
Good evening.
Yeah, I should mention also that Kennedys and King is a big staple of why you're on every second week or so, just to promote what's on there. And man, there's some bad research out there, so it's just a breath of fresh air to find good research.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. I mean, it depends if you agree with the article or this or that. Or last week I had John Armstrong on, and he can be some people just don't like him, but he always finds something worthwhile, and you go, maybe I don't subscribe to everything, but you know, as long as people are doing, you know, not like the other people that are still clinging to Lee Oswald did it and the Warren Commission, and oh, it's sickening.
I agree. Speaking of Kennedys and King, you're going to have some people on that have written stuff for us. John Washburn has written a three-part series on the Tippit murder, which a lot of people were really very much impressed with. And I don't blame them, because he did a lot of really original work on this. Okay, and it's from a different point of view. It's from the police officer's testimony and how he was proving that it was false. And so you have to then ask the question, well, why? Okay, why were they making up stories about the Tippit case? So he's going to be on your show. That's terrific. I think he'll make for a very good guest. Paul Abbott, who you've had on before, and who I hope you have on again, has written a story about... See, and this is something that is an important subject that he's writing about here. See, although the Warren Commission tried to make out like everybody on the commission and the commission staff was all 100% aligned with what Dulles and McCloy said, as we've learned, that's not really the case. Okay? There was some internal dissent about the ultimate result of the commission. And we've gone over this many times before about Richard Russell, Cooper, and Boggs. You know, they became the first people to break away from the Warren Commission in public. Well, he's bringing up Leon Hubert and Bert Griffin, who were more or less complaining about the lack of completeness about the Jack Ruby investigation and also Ruby's murder of Oswald. Okay, I've never seen some of the stuff he has in there. He has a long memo that Hubert and Griffin wrote to the commission that never really got answered. So that's an interesting article, and I hope you have him on to talk about it. And then the most recent one we have is a two-parter by Johnny Cairns, and this is a long review of the new book by Larry Hancock and Dave Boylan called The Oswald Puzzle. Now, did you have Larry on?
Not to talk about this, no.
Okay.
I just had him on about the court case things, you know, the legal battles they were having.
About his what?
Well, they were trying to sue to release the documents, right?
I didn't know that he had filed a lawsuit.
A couple of people, right? You know, I even think...
Oh, are you talking about the Simpich thing?
Yeah, and Andrew Eiler.
With Larry?
Yeah, and there's...
Oh, Mary Farrell Foundation.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right. Okay, but this is about the book that he co-wrote with Dave Boylan, in which the overall thesis is that Oswald really was a leftist. And so Johnny doesn't agree with that. Okay, and so he's done a two-part essay. Part one is up. Part two will be up probably by tomorrow or the next day. And to be frank, I have a lot of problems with this also, but I'm glad Johnny agreed to actually do the review, and I hope you have him on because it's a pretty interesting review. All right, now, I think, are you going to announce that you're going to have a big celebrity on?
No, not yet, no. No,
I'll not? Wait. Okay, yeah. All right. One thing I wanted to talk, every once in a while we get into related subjects, okay, or things that are in a matter of controversy, okay, that's in the popular discussion. And I think everybody is aware of what happened with Trump, Vance, and Zelensky, okay, a few days ago in the Oval Office. That flare-up, which you really, really don't see very much of, that made me wonder. And so I bought Scott Horton's book, Provoked, which, do you have it yet?
No, I don't have it yet, but I plan to get it.
Okay. It's a very long book. I think in the paperback, it's like 690 pages. And there are things in there that I wish he would have cut out or at least shortened. But there is so much good information in that book that it inspired me to go ahead and write a four-part series on this subject for my Substack site, okay? I had just done one about the Barry Weiss, Eli Lake attack on Oliver Stone, all right? And then I decided to do this, to do a four-part series on this whole Ukraine controversy, largely based upon his, you know, and there's also, he's not the only really good guy out there on this. There's your guy, what's his name again, Benz?
Mike Benz?
I mean, you know, okay.
You can get a combination. If you listen to Jeffrey Sachs, Mike Benz, Colonel Douglas McGregor, you know, Scott Horton, geez, there's a couple of guys that have been on Joe Rogan's show too. The amount of subversion by USAID and the whole background, mm-hmm. Victoria Nuland, I mean, you almost have to unlearn everything you've heard and go, you know, like the Oliver Stone film, the white is black and black is white. I mean, the opposite of everything they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I had a small argument with somebody and they were talking about disinfo and I said, well, who blew up the pipeline after all, right? And that famous thing with Joe Biden, where he said, I went there and I had $5 billion coming to them and I told them, if you don't fire the prosecutor...
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not getting the money. And I
yes.
waited in my plane and he said, whatever he said, by George, they fired the prosecutor and they got their $5 billion. I mean, it's so corrupt and just, it's really eye-opening.
Well, Scott Horton writes that the United States tried to overthrow the government in Belarus. They tried to do that twice under W. Once in 2001, once in 2005.
Yeah, I think it's Belarus.
Yeah, okay, thank you. All right. And then they successfully did the same thing in Georgia. They got rid of Shevardnadze. These were not spontaneous uprisings. The United States poured tens of millions into both of those areas in order to... And here's the problem. They both border Russia, okay. All right, and then, of course, you had the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, and that was to get rid of...
Yeah, with Mike...
That was to get rid of Yanukovych. What's his name?
Yanukovych. Yeah, Yanukovych.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and Mike Benz called it a rent-a-riot, and then one of these leaked phone calls...
A what?
Rent-a-riot.
Rent-a-riot,
yeah. You know, where he says, you put enough money in, and you tell people to go down to the square and protest... You know, everybody's getting paid, and they're down there, and you think it's a real revolution where it's a dog and pony show.
$65 million for the Orange Revolution. Okay. That's what it cost to get rid of that guy. And it was all, he goes into, Scott Horton goes into how it was, how the pattern was all scripted to begin with. And it was largely done, although not completely done, by these NGOs. And you're exactly right. USAID finances a lot of, well, I don't think there is a USAID anymore, but they financed a lot of these NGOs that, you know, out of the National Endowment for Democracy.
That's a non-governmental organization, if somebody doesn't
know. Right, that's what it's supposed to be, but it really isn't. Okay, you know, and on the on this one in Ukraine, in the Orange Revolution, this was supplemented by the CIA and MI6. Okay, they were also in on it. So you really have to wonder, and Putin himself wondered about it. Okay, and not just him, but like Pat Buchanan, you know, and other commentators. What is the point of taking NATO, and then in addition to that, starting these color revolutions right on the border of Russia? Isn't it, and Pat Buchanan said this, isn't it more important to have good relations with Moscow than it is with, say, Prague or Budapest or whatever, you know? I mean, isn't that, and wasn't this an opportune time to do it with the fall of the USSR? Okay, so what was the point of doing all this? And it was, the only explanation that Scott Horton comes to is that the neocons wanted to start a whole Cold War II, second version. And in this one, they were going to stomp all over Russia because of the fall of the USSR. Okay. It's really an, you know, it's really an unnerving kind of exposure of what the heck is going on there, you know.
And even Robert Kennedy Jr. has made some, you know, Ukraine explained in 5 minutes. And he says they want these countries to join NATO, and then they have to buy the NATO-specific machinery, weapons, so they have to spend money onto that. And America these days doesn't seem to be making anything but weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, and by the way, this has not been, as Scott Horton points out, this has not been a partisan thing. Both the Democrats and Republicans, you know, have been in on this, from Bush 1 to Clinton to Bush 2 to Obama, and Biden was probably the worst. You know, Biden, you know, the more I learn about Biden's foreign policy, you know, the more I really don't like it. You know, he was really as bad as Hillary Clinton, you know, a Democratic neocon.
Or if you want to make a worse case, he's asleep at the wheel and other people are running it.
Well, that might be true also. Yes.
They said they looked at his last, and I don't have the numbers right, but his last 50 to 100 things that he's supposed to have signed, and they're all identical. They're done with an electronic signature that somebody just mm-hmm. stamped it, and you wonder if he even read these documents. It's just all a computer signature.
Well, there's a new book coming out on this, you know. It's co-written with Jake Tapper about, you know, was Biden, you know, I don't know if I told you this, but Lisa Peace told me this. Like 4 or 5 months ago? No, it might have been even longer than that. It was before the election. Okay, and she told me over lunch, goes, Jim, you know, Biden has dementia. I said, are you serious? She goes, yeah, I've heard it from a number of sources. You know, because she used to be into that Democratic politics kind of thing. So she had some sources there. And I think that's what this upcoming book is going to be about.
Yeah, but the poverty of that, Jake Tapper, the guys that deny, oh, you know, what was it, Morning Joe said, this is the best Biden ever. This is the best. He's in this game, right? And then he's on TV and everybody goes, and even Trump, I mean, love him or hate him, but he goes, I don't even think he knows what he just said. You remember that on one of the debates? And it was like,
yes, I remember that, yeah.
And, you know, that's the bad thing about, you know, every now and then, like the quote I liked from Trump was, this lady says, well, who do you want to win? You want Ukraine to win or you want Putin to win? Which one? And he goes, look, I want to end the killing. Stop the killing. People mm-hmm. are dying. Just stop the war and let's work something out. And it's like Jeffrey Sachs is saying, we don't have
diplomats.
We don't have diplomats anymore. We just have warhawks and neocons. And when is somebody other than, you know, if I thought about Jeffrey Sachs, you know, he seems to be well respected by all sorts of people. You don't have to pick a side. And he got up in the United Nations, or no, in NATO, and made a speech, and Oliver Stone had just...
I think that was a European Union.
Oh, yeah. I stand corrected. Mm. Okay, right. But, right, to say, listen, like Scott Horton's book, don't say it's not provoked, you know? I mean, this whole thing has gone on, and luckily, somebody has stood up to them, and of all the unlikely people, you know, not a lot of people hate them, Trump has stood up to them and said, what the hell are you guys spending money on? And some of these things, if you find them, if you look into it, like somebody named 20, I forget if it was on... Russell Brand or Joe Rogan or whoever, a lot of people I listen to, they just named what all these guys are spending millions and millions on transgendered mice studies, on TV shows in Rwanda. I mean, just, and when you find the money, it's $10 million here, $20 million there, $50 million here, and then you go there, it's an empty building with nothing, you know?
The Institute. Well, let me say something about that. Kennedy started USAID. And I think I said this before, but I'm going to say it again. But when he started it, it was purely in order to help third world countries and in order to compete with the Soviet Union in the third world. That's what he started it for. So he would give things like, you know, food and medicine and loans to these third world countries. Like a popular one for him was Egypt. Okay, because he thought he could work through Gamal Abdel Nasser in order to westernize and modernize the Middle East. But as time went on, and after Kennedy was killed, USAID got completely out of control. There simply was not enough oversight and analysis as to what the heck they're supposed to be doing. So when people try and say, well, Kennedy started it, well, no. Kennedy didn't start what USAID became. He started it as a way to, what you just said, to foster diplomacy, you know, in the third world and to compete with Moscow, you know, in the third world. Because Kennedy always said, look, if we compete with Moscow in trying to get these third world countries to align themselves with us, we can win because we have more to offer. And this is one of the big things, arguments he had with Dulles, with John Foster Dulles, okay, when John Foster Dulles would not allow non-aligned countries, or he would cut off aid, you know, because he had a foreign policy disagreement with them. And this is what he did with Nasser. And JFK thought that was really dumb. You know, he always thought that, look, we can compete with the Russians. We can offer these countries what they need. And like I said, Nasser was a big target for him because he thought that Nasser was, and this is absolutely true, okay, he was the prime guy for all the Arab countries in the Middle East. And if he could get Nasser, you know, to align himself or at least talk to him, okay, about negotiations, he thought that, A, he could go ahead and have a lot of influence in the Arab countries in the Middle East. And secondly, that we wouldn't have to have this constant tension between Israel and the Arab countries. And after reading a lot about this, I've come to the conclusion that he was correct and that there would have been no 1967 war if Kennedy had lived. You know, USAID was... you know, a part of that at the beginning, but it wasn't towards the end. And I have to say, I don't agree with Trump and Elon Musk on a lot of things. Okay, but that's one that I'd be forced to agree with them on. By the way, my younger sister went to an anti-Elon Musk rally on Sunday. She's going to send me some pictures about what went on there. I said, Carol, you know something? I hope you brought a can of mace with you, because those people get violent.
Yeah, people sure get mad, eh? You just, it's too bad you can't have a conflicting view, like, well, I like him, I like that people are, you know, saying we're not going to buy the Tesla car. We're not going. Meanwhile, he's doing so many other things. I heard him. He was on Joe Rogan just last week. As you know, I was traveling the last 2 weeks, so on, you know, 4 or 5 hour car trips, we were just listening to every lecture we could get to, right? You know, like, anyway, Joe Rogan's one of them. Those are 3 hours. And I found it very, very educational, entertaining, and I didn't find anything to dislike. But some people, they go, well, I didn't vote for him. I didn't vote for him. I mean, God, there's so many people that did get elected that, you know, talk about Lindsey Graham. You know, some of these guys, I just can't, well, I don't want to jump on the bandwagon and say I can't stand the guy. But, you know, there's people that were elected, and you go, what the hell is wrong with you guys? So, yeah, I mean, I watched Trump's speech. You know, it kind of got him went off the rails, but there was a few things. The first,
it was 100 minutes long.
No, well, whatever, but we watched maybe the first 45. And, you know, he said, look, from now on, it's going to be men and women separate sports. Like, no men in women's sports. And there's only two genders. Forget that. And I just kind of thought, you know, I can subscribe to that. I mean, it's getting out of hand. I mean, just so many things were kind of getting out of hand. You know, I'm sure he's going to go too far. And, he's talking about starting his trade wars with Canada, which Canada you think would be your cousin, your best neighbor.
Canada's retaliating.
Well, yeah. Like I said, we're putting on 25% tariffs, and then the Premier of Ontario says, well, we're going to do that on electricity. We can cut you off. And then he says, oh, you want a war the likes of which they'll be writing in history books for years, you know? And it's like, you know, you might reconsider some of these tariffs, or you might, okay, tell you what, I'll cut it in half, whatever. I think in that Ontario, Windsor area, a lot of car parts are made now in Canada because of the 75-cent dollar. For some reason, and I cannot figure that one out, our dollar's sitting at about 75 cents compared to the American dollar. Yet we have oil, we have water, we have trees, we have so many things that you'd think the dollar would be the same, but the financial people have, you know, so it's already... You're kind of shortchanged, and now he's mad at Canada.
I heard in Canada they started taking American liquor off the shelves.
Oh, many things. Yeah, it's gone. Yeah, it is. Well, you know what? It's kind of they should just.
And this new guy, the new Liberal Party leader, he already made it very clear. We're not going to take this. We will never be the 51st state. Okay.
Well, you know. They took Russian vodka off the shelves there, too, as well, you know?
Okay.
I didn't go for that. If you don't like something, don't buy it, you know? And if you don't really, if you hate Tesla, then don't buy the car. But, you know, if there's a boycott on something and it means that much to you, you do that. But when you take them down, I used to make a joke. I said, I can't even get Russian dressing anymore. Thanks for laughing.
All right. Okay. So let's go to the letters, which we're always getting no matter what. Okay. And this one is from Stephen McMahon, February 21st. Mr. DiEugenio, please try to contact whoever you need to, hopefully Mr. Trump himself. We shouldn't have the files reviewed by a congressional committee, no matter how good the members are. Yourself, Vince Palamara, and a few more writers, journalists should do it, as was with the Twitter files. They brought in Matt Taibbi on that, right?
Yeah, Matt Taibbi and Schellenberg. I think that's his last name.
Okay.
They brought in several people, but I thought they were very good. They very slowly started, they didn't just rush everything out, and they very slowly started putting out on their Substacks what they found. And it, again, it was like jaw-dropping. What do you mean all these ex-FBI and other people are in there? And now, I would say thank goodness for Elon Musk for buying Twitter to reveal how bad free speech was. Just how bad
it was. And by the way, let me tell the viewing audience, excuse me, the listening audience, that is no exaggeration. There were at least 11 FBI agents, former FBI agents who were censoring stuff on the former Twitter forum. That's just sickening. You know, I mean, you know, to have that many FBI people, you know, going out, first of all, They didn't want the Hunter Biden stuff out. Okay? They wanted to label that all as Russian disinformation, which it ended up not being. Okay? You know,
but worse than that, it's not that it ended up. It never was. And when you look at who funded it, Hillary, and all, it really stinks. So when one of the things that Trump did is Tulsi Gabbard revoked the status classifications, right, for these 51 people. They took away. You know, it's unbelievable. And you kind of go, I really agree with that. Although I'm no fan of Trump, and because of his stance on Canada, I'm pretty grumpy about the thing, But I got to give credit. I mean, those people, they were, not that they were wrong, they were lying from the start.
Yes, yes. And it's amazing, people say, how can you say that the JFK case was a big conspiracy? Do you really think all those people, here's a prime example of what's called a big conspiracy. Okay, this conspiracy to censor the Twitter forum. Okay, many, many people were involved, including the ownership. So when people say, what do you think? They all got in a room. Yeah, it's what I think. That's what happened. What do you think they did in a park? Okay, they all got in some secret room and plotted this thing out, just like they did this. So in other words, you could have big conspiracies like Watergate or Iran-Contra or this, but you can't have them in the JFK case. Okay, please, give me a break,
Yeah, security clearance was the word I was thinking of there.
That's what they did, yes.
Yeah. And I applaud that. I mean, who knows what else you guys did, but at least we caught you on this.
Mm-hmm.
And on sad news is that Trump said he had 45 days to release the JFK files and the Epstein Island files, they're not out.
The Epstein thing is something that's creating a kind of controversy now because of the redacted form that they were released in. And people are getting actually on alternative media and talking about this. Don't do this with JFK, all right? Okay, so let me finish this question from Stephen McMahon. Yourself, Vince Palamerica, and a few more writers, journalists should do it, like with the Twitter files. Okay, they will review, and it will be the same old story all over, page after page of redactions. Well, if you can believe it, and this is true, Robert Kennedy Jr. got in contact with Lisa. Lisa got in contact with me. And Bobby is going to try and influence this through his daughter-in-law, Amaryllis Fox. And so there is some hope that we're going to have something to say about this Luna committee. And I don't know, have you seen her on TV?
No, not really. I rarely watch TV. I mean, rarely.
Well, how about YouTube? She's on YouTube also.
Yeah. No, I've just seen her at the podium speaking, but she was kind of defending... I think it was on Redacted. She was being interviewed quickly for 15 minutes, and I was like, oh, they're not.
Oh, you sent me that. You sent me that.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I'm not saying that she's 100% with us, but she actually didn't seem too bad, on that show that you sent me, which, of course, is unredacted, yeah. So I think, she's actually going to try and do something correctly, and hopefully with this other influence, we might be able to have some say in this. But the thing is, what's important is, first we got Trump, then we got Bobby Kennedy, and we got Luna and this committee.
Yeah, Tulsi Gabbard, too.
Right. I think Tulsi will be pretty good also on this. So let's keep our fingers crossed, and hopefully something good, will come of all this. We'll finally get the last of the documents. Now, I've seen various estimates of how many documents there are as opposed to pages. The estimates I see are about 4,000. I don't know how many pages that is. It's probably quite a lot of pages, because these FBI documents are usually 3, 4, 5, 6 pages long. So I think that we'll be, and according to my sources, that is Andrew Eiler and Paul Blow, who are down at NARA, a lot of these documents, the metadata is that they deal with Oswald in Mexico City, which, as you know, has always been a point of interest for myself. Okay, I really hope we finally get the last of these documents. You know, the Lopez report was very good, and if you haven't read that, you really should. But I would like to get the last of the documents that somehow, some way, the CIA does not want us to read. I have no idea why, but I would really like to find out. Okay, so that's Stephen McMahon. All right, Stephen Terp. I've never seen an explanation as to why Oswald was in the lunchroom, seemingly totally disinterested, while everyone else in Dealey Plaza was watching the presidential motorcade. Do you have any theories? Thank you. Well, you had Bart Camp on, didn't you?
Yeah.
It might be that Oswald wasn't there. Bart Camp wrote a pretty good book about the whole prayer man theory, which I did a review of, and Len had him on. Okay, now, I'm not saying this is 100% the truth, but I'm saying there does seem to me to be something there. And if you haven't, you don't know what that is or the idea, you can look it up very easily. Bart Camp has a whole website that is devoted to the whole prayer man idea. So it might be that he really wasn't in the lunchroom like many, many people thought he was. That might be him outside on the top of the stairs. If you're looking at the picture head on, he's on the left side. So that might be the case. Now, the old theory went that Oswald just wasn't even aware that there was going to be a motorcade route that day, that he was made to learn about it that morning, okay, by, I think it was like 10 a.m. or something, okay, that he first learned about it. Okay, so that might be, you know, the reason that he was in the lunchroom at that time. He didn't have any background on, you know, on the whole parade that was going to be taking place in front.
Yeah, he could have had a whole other scenario in his mind that he was going to be taken to the Redbird Field, and he might have been flown out of the country, and he was going to be on some assignment. And meanwhile, this parade is just small potatoes for what's brewing in his
head. Yes, that's another option, all right? But anyway, that's some of the alternative ideas about what, A, if Oswald was in the lunchroom, and B, if he was prayer man. We can say with pretty much finality that he wasn't on the sixth floor. That was always one of the weakest parts of the whole Warren Commission report, that Oswald somehow could have done what he did and then ran down those stairs and then be at that soda machine with the cop and the supervisor walking in so quickly. I mean, that was just, you know, when I started, that's one of the things, when I first started on this case, that's one of the things that really stuck out at me like a sore thumb. You're going to tell me that this guy got off those three shots, then ran over to the other side of the room, shoved the rifle down between some boxes, then flew down five flights of stairs, okay, and was sitting coolly at this soda machine all within about 75 seconds, you know, and plus the two girls from the fourth floor didn't see him, you know, Vicki Adams and Sandy Stiles, you know. By the way, when I was working for Oliver, that's what he said too, that one of the things when he started researching JFK that really stuck out to him was the whole thing about Vicki Adams and Sandy Stiles.
And how their testimony was treated, and then they weren't called.
Right.
And, you know, you can
well,
see.
She was called, but she said, why don't you call Sandy? And they wouldn't call Sandy.
Right.
Okay.
Like, there are other people that can verify my story when they said, well, we don't believe you, right? You're mistaken. Oh, yeah, right? And so
There
that
were three other
obfuscation.
people.
Yeah, that
There were three other
obfuscation.
people.
Yeah.
That really shows you just how dishonest and how rigged the Warren Commission was. The guy in charge of that particular cover-up was Bellin. He's the one who didn't want to call Sandy Stiles. And then they found out, I think it was in July, there was a letter from the attorney, the state attorney general for out of Washington, located in Dallas. And she sent that letter to Rankin saying words of the effect that Victoria's supervisor backed up her story, that the policeman didn't come up the stairs until after Vicky and Sandy went down.
Yeah.
You know, when you start doing that kind of stuff, you know, when you cut out Sandy Stiles completely and then you censor that letter because it's not in the Warren Commission, you know, and so I think I might be right about this. I think Max Good, who wrote that book, The Girl on the Stairs, he found that letter in 1999 as a result of the ARB. So if it wasn't for the ARB, we would have never known that. So anyway, these are some of the interesting tangents about, you know, where was Oswald at the time of and very shortly after the actual assassination, one of the weakest parts of the entire Warren Commission, 888 pages, you know, of the Warren Commission report. I mean, David Bellin was pumping a lot of gas, you know, on that one. You know, sometimes I don't know who was worse, Bellin or Spector. You can flip a coin. All right, Roger Scott Caffey. This is from February the 25th. In the Nigel Turner film, The Men Who Killed Kennedy, a segment includes the lawyer of Christian David, David from whom Steve Revelle learned the name of Lucien Sarté as one of the shooters of JFK. David's lawyer said entrusted him with a sealed letter revealing what he knew about the Kennedy assassination, only to be opened upon his release from prison. My questions are, is David still alive? If he's passed, which is a kind of release, has his lawyer revealed the content of the letter? Also, if you have Revelle's email, can you share it? Thank you for your attention. All right. Steve Revelle passed away about 4 or 5 months ago. Okay, so we can't consult him. But Revelle wrote a book on this subject that I believe was published in France, and it was the original inspiration for The Men Who Killed Kennedy. The day after that part was broadcast, the French newspapers exposed it as being false. Okay, every single one of those guys, Sarté was dead, but they found records that he was in a prison at that time. And the other two guys also had alibis. So I believe Christian David was using that as a kind of phony excuse in order for somebody to take up his case, okay? Because I think he was in prison at the time. As per Nigel Turner, well, what can you say? The first time around, the guy went with this Steve Revelle story about the Corsican mob, okay, and these three guys that he named. Then, when that fell apart, he went to the whole thing about Mack Wallace, which didn't hold up either, because as Joan Mellon did in her book on Lyndon Johnson, the so-called fingerprint was not Wallace's fingerprint, and Wallace was not in Dallas, okay, at that time. So I don't have a lot of patience with Nigel Turner or his series, and I think I've said this before. I believe that Nigel Turner blew a very good opportunity to do some very good work, and he didn't do his homework on things like this. And I really think that, you know, look, we all make mistakes. Everybody in this field has made mistakes. Nobody can say they have never made a mistake in the JFK case. But something like that, you know, was something that, you know, with the time and the money and the people that Turner had, he should have done a lot more due diligence than he did on those two cases. I mean, it's pretty obvious that from the title, he wanted to have a twist on the Kennedy assassination series. In other words, he wasn't just going to prove there was a conspiracy. He was determined to show who actually did it, and that would give some pizzazz to his series. When you end up going 0 for 2, okay, that's not a very good batting average.
Well, I can share you something. It's just an anecdote, but when I was talking to Fletcher Prouty about it, he said, you know, he kind of leaned back wistfully. When I first heard from Nigel Turner, he said his script was really well. It was something that I decided I would get behind because it was on. And he said, then I didn't hear from him for months. You know, they came and filmed me for his segment. You know, he's on there. And he goes, then when it came out, he goes, I was terribly disappointed. And he goes, I had the feeling that he was victim of a mole. Somebody got into his organization and tried to steer things sideways. And before you know it, what he had planned didn't turn out. Now, that's Fletcher's view of it, because when I asked him what he thought of it. And that very well could be the case, too, that you start out with good intentions, and then somebody says, oh, well, I got this Corsican guy. Yeah, and they all did it, you know. Well, okay, well, we got to, you know, we got to go there, right? And, you know.
The second time he fell for Barr McClellan, you know, and
oh,
that
I
book,
think Judy,
I think it's called.
Judy Baker was in there, too, right?
Oh, my God, you're right.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm having such painful memories. Okay. There was, I think he devoted a whole program to Judy Baker.
I'm not
if
sure.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah. And then you know, the Madeleine Brown, you either subscribe to that or you don't. And if you don't, then
right.
It's kind of like that whole.
And then, the party at the Murchisons.
Right. That's what I was
getting
at. That
whole thing,
yeah.
You know? Yeah.
So,
okay, so,
you know, it's for discussion. But, you know, I'm glad he made it. And on you know, very, like, we've been studying this for years. So we're getting into the nitty-gritty details, you know. And if you're wrong about something, it's too far after the fact.
Well, see, the only good thing about that is that when it was reissued in the second version, it was pretty much timed as so many other things were. With the Oliver Stone's JFK film. And it was the combination of that one on TV plus the other one in the theaters, okay, that really created some momentum, okay, to
and public interest.
Get the review board.
Yeah.
All right.
Public interest. And they really put A&E on the map. It came out in British TV, right? But when it came to A&E, they played it, you know, every Friday over weeks. Then with that interest that Bill Curtis, they had one on the Bobby Kennedy assassination and so many others. And then that started a whole other series called American Justice, where they started to go through court cases and you know, events that were, you know, people were saying, I knew that was crooked, that, you know, this, many things like that. I think that same channel, I'm not sure if they're called Ootmore Productions, but anyway, whatever the channel was, that aired it. They also did one for Martin Luther King assassination, you know, in which they had Bill Pepper and a few other people on. So they did galvanize that, look, at the public is really still interested in this and we should do something. Well, I tell you what has stood the test of time is 50 Reasons for 50 Years.
That was very good. That was very good. And also Jeff's movie about Fletcher Prouty.
Yeah.
Was very well received.
Yeah.
And I think, isn't that streaming now?
Yeah, you can get it on Vimeo, and I've made links to it. Got some very complimentary notes from Oliver Stone, which just made it worthwhile, you know, because he took part in it as well.
Jeff deserves Well, didn't you help him on that?
Yeah, but we worked on many things. But, you know, I had this big timeline on my wall. I looked at it for 10 years and how I was going to plan it, the Fletcher Prouty documentary. But I was just doing so many other things, I never got it off the wall. And he said, well, let's do something more with it. And I said, look, here's the material. Here, I got all this interviews. I got video. I've got stuff. I've got paperwork to back it up. And he just started chipping away at it. And I think it might have been because of COVID at the time, too, that people had time on their hands to do something they never had. But, I mean, just, you know, it was me and Jeff, two people, and we pumped out 50 Reasons for 50 Years, as well as me doing 52 shows that year of Black Op Radio. That there was a
you were a busy guy.
Yeah, it was a really big effort.
Mm-hmm.
I was a couple of things really catalyzed me to do that. One was the Gary Mack was getting all this attention, and the 2013 and the city of Dallas was going to clamp down, and you had to have a security check to even get in, and then there were going to be these free speech protest zones that were chain linked off. Oh, it was sickening, and so
yeah, it was pretty bad. It was awful.
Yeah. It was awful.
Did you go?
No, I didn't go.
Okay. Unfortunately, I did. Okay. And it was a very sickening spectacle to watch. You know, and from my sources, this was a triangular plan between Gary Mack and the Sixth Floor, the Dallas Morning News, and the mayor's office. Okay, they consciously worked on this thing for months in advance that they were not going to have any people like me standing up in Dealey Plaza.
Yeah, or John Judge even, you know, who'd been doing it for years.
Yeah, any of those people, you know, they were not going to be in the middle of Dealey Plaza because the reason being that they knew there would be a huge media contingent there. And so, in other words, we would have gotten airtime and TV time from all over the world because there were channels and newspapers and networks from all over the world who came in for that. Okay, and that's, you know, and so again, say when people say, you know, I don't believe in big conspiracies, well, maybe that's not a conspiracy because it was done more or less out in the open. Okay, but that's another example.
Oh, it's an organized effort.
Yes. You know, and I, you know, I have nothing but scorn for that kind of, you know, for everybody who's supposed to believe in democracy, for everybody who's supposed to believe in free speech. That was a purely preemptive action that was taken. So there would not be free speech. There would not be a democratic debate. That's what that was all about. All right? You know, so...
And think of the number of times that Gary Mack had Robert Groden arrested. Was it upwards of around 80?
Well, it wasn't really arrested. It was charged.
Well, they took him. They took him down to the station.
Yeah, a few times they actually did do that. Okay? But they wanted him out of Dealey Plaza. And according to Bob... You know, it was done at the instigation of Gary Mack.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't want any competition for the Sixth Floor. And then when Bob was inquiring about buying an office across the street from the Sixth Floor, they heard about it and they went ahead and they bought it before he could get it. You know? So that's what, you know, the powers that be, you know, in Dallas have always been about. You know, when Jim Mars was alive, he told me the same thing. He goes, you know, they've never been able to accept what happened here or to go ahead and face it head on or honestly. You know, they were even thinking at one time, according to Jim Mars, they were even thinking one time about raising the Texas School Book Depository, okay, you know, but everybody said, well, instead of doing that, why don't we turn it into a more or less Warren Commission, you know, memorial, okay, and that will get this issue off our back, you know, and so that's what they then decided to do. The powers that be meaning some of the very wealthy people in Dallas-Fort Worth, and there are a lot of them, you know, and the power brokers there decided to put up this museum that more or less commemorates the official story, you know, and that's how that came about, you know. So in other words, it's okay for the rich and powerful people to do something like that. That's fine if you have the access and if you have the ability to do it, you know. Might makes right, you know, as the old saying goes. And then it culminated at the 50th anniversary, where they essentially, and I was there, so I know this, they blocked off the whole area to make sure that only the people that were cleared in advance, you know, would be able to go ahead and enter that whole Dealey Plaza triangle. And I know this because, for example, they had police on horseback. You know, they must have had at least 150 policemen cordoning off that area, you know. And when I say cordoning off, it was blocked. It was blocked, you know, by those wooden, you know, those wooden obstructions.
Barricades, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it was literally barricaded off. That's a good word. Okay. You couldn't get in unless you were authorized to get in, you know. And unfortunately, you had Alex Jones there, you know, with his bullhorn, you know, trying to provoke these police officers, you know, but it didn't. Thank God it didn't work. That would have been a real spectacle. So it was really, you know, if you want to talk about a state of denial, all right, that was a very, very good example of a preemptive attack on a state to go ahead and prolong the state of denial. And then, of course, you know, one of the most incredible things I ever saw is that all the major networks hooked up to this thing. I mean, because we were watching it from a donut shop across the street, and we're looking up at the TV, and all the major networks are broadcast. And see, this is why they did it.
So I that even they heard could that channel. The Blue Angels were going to fly over or something like that.
I think that actually did happen. I think if I recall correctly, that actually did happen. And this was topped off, of course, and I've never been able to figure this out. David McCullough was the main speaker. Len, what has David McCullough ever done on the John F. Kennedy biography scene? I mean, I've never seen anything that David McCullough has done. I mean, he's done biographies of Adams. He's done biographies of Truman. I've never seen him do anything of any significance on the John F. Kennedy case or the biography of him. So what was the point of having him there? Was it for that very reason? You know, because they knew he wouldn't have anything provocative to say, because he wouldn't bring up anything about Vietnam, maybe, you know. That was just mind-boggling, a very sad spectacle to see. Okay, but again, that's when you have these networking things. And by the way, somebody actually sent me the emails about this. I think the mayor's name was Rawlings or something. Okay, it was between him, the Dallas Morning News, and the Sixth Floor. They were all arranging this thing months in advance to make sure that we wouldn't be there, you know. So that's denialism for you. That's censorship for you. You know, that's making a mockery, you know, out of freedom of speech, you know, and the whole democratic idea of having an open debate to decide things, you know. So anyway, so I answered all the questions. Okay. Thanks for having me on, Len.
Okay, great. So just a recap of what's going to be coming up in Kennedys and King in the future?
We're going to have a second part to Johnny Cairns that's going to be going up very soon. And we're going to have Mark Adamczyk, who is very good on the JFK Act. He is going to be doing an article about the files. Okay, and I think we're going to have Andrew Eiler on also. He's going to be doing an article about his whole discovery. Did Paul Blue talk about this, about the final determinations? Did he talk about that at all?
Not too much, but I'll wait for that to come out then. And then also
okay,
you're
going to
maybe, after you finish with the Unprovoked book, maybe write a review?
No, I'm actually basing my Substack series on the book.
Oh, the series on the book.
Okay. Yeah, right. So just go ahead to my Substacks. And by the way, there's a lot of interested people in the subject, you know, because, you know, like one guy even wrote, you know, Jim, the information you're putting on here is like the other side of the moon. I mean, it goes against almost everything. And, well, that's what we're supposed to be about, isn't it? You know, telling the censored story.
Or at least just telling the truth.
And, right.
You know, it's just in this case... With that topic, it's so unbelievable that every day you see these people. It's the same thing. I'm seeing an awful lot of news come out about vaccines and about the COVID one and how harmful it really is and how many mistakes they made. And you know, there's a real backlash to next time when they say, listen, it should have been for elderly people. They should have never used those intubators, whatever they're called, ventilators.
Ventilators, yeah.
Yeah, and then they... just so many things, but if you don't take the shot, you're fired. And you know, and a number of people have said once you take it, it stops it cold, you know, and that's just not the truth at all. Anyway, yeah, well, we focus mostly on the JFK and those, like the four assassinations of the 60s that your book first really broke a lot of ground with, linking them all together, how this whole movement. And like you say, if you don't believe conspiracies, let's just talk about coincidences. All right, then, Jim, thank you so much for making time tonight, and we'll be in touch.
Okay.
All right.
Have a good night. Bye-bye.
You too. Thank you.